everybody, and welcome to episode 129 of the Alexi Sale podcast. If you've made it this far, then you know that I don't know. I was going to improvise something about like as if it was a murder story, like a story that was going to have an ending. You know?
Yes.
If you come this far, then you'll know that Simeon has learned by now that Jacinto is actually an agent for International Mining Conglomerate. Meanwhile, Marcus discovers that he has feelings for Arabutla, and things come to a head in the grain store.
And of course, last week,
last week's episode,
Mrs. Bryan's,
yeah.
The head of year 9 at Mildred High, while searching through the storeroom for some HB pencils, found an ancient treasure chest containing golden idol heads from the Incan tribes.
Yeah. But unfortunately, we now learn this week's episode that these do not come with an ancient curse attached.
Unfortunately not, no. But she does make a considerable fortune auctioning them off.
Yeah. In other another news. Raven gets a cat.
And this whole episode this week is a bottle episode of Raven and her cat.
Yeah. What's a bottle episode?
Oh, so like in a TV series, if they need to save some money or do a cheapish episode, they'll just do a whole episode set in one location with very minimal, minimal characters and props.
Yeah.
And
do that.
So there's just, Raven and then
Raven and a cat,
waiting for a delivery.
Toys.
Yep.
You said a lot's been happening, which comes as news to me, but what's been happening?
I thought we'd get your insight on last night. So we're recording this on Friday the 19th.
This is my 2 kopecks worth. You what?
It was election night last night.
Election where Andy Burnham, where it doesn't do him any good.
Burn him? Hardly know him.
No. It's like, tight under. Was it Hampton Court? No, tight underpants. You daft twat. Piston broke. Yeah, well, you too.
Andy Ben.
Yeah, he did. It's a it's a weird sexual thing that we have going on between us. It's a dark corner of the internet featuring testicles and blow torches.
Andrew Feinstein.
What's he done?
Andrew Feinstein. No, there's no pun there.
No. Andy Burnham. Turn him green. Well, it doesn't do him any good.
That's good. I can't think of a good one.
Yeah. Well, you haven't had my 300 years in show business.
That's true. I did see a recent someone questioning Burnham in the street about his stance on Palestine, because historically he has been vocal about it, but in the last few months,
he's in Labour friend to fucking Israel. So.
No, he's not.
He is. It's 2015.
Fuck off. Oh, my God. No, he's not.
He was in Labour friend to Palestine as well. I don't know whether, but that was.
But isn't that Labour kind of, you're automatically in it and you have to opt out? If you're a member of the Labour Party, you're automatically put in Labour friend to Israel.
I don't think so. Yeah. Well, this is my take. I think. Well, he's going to be a tremendous disappointment. If you, the Andy Burnham's Maker Field seat was gifted to him by a guy called Josh Simmons. Josh Simmons was, when he was an MP, chair of a group called Labour Friends. What were they called? They're called Labour Together, who we've talked about before with the journalist Paul Holden. Josh Simmons also was guilty and had to resign his post because he hired private detectives to spy on Paul Holden and also threatened them with entirely spurious reference to security services. Now, it seems to me that Burnham has done a deal with Josh Simmons, that Josh Simmons gave him his seat, because he's a really, I think, an extremely ambitious and thrusting character, Simmons, that he's done a deal with Simmons, that Simmons is going to be there in the background advising, in inverted commas, Andy Burnham, and he's done some sort of deal with Labour Together. And so part of that deal will be that he will be in a straitjacket of right-wing Labourism. He won't do anything about the disgraceful prescription of Palestine action. He won't do anything about, Britain's arms trade with Israel. He won't do anything about anything, really, because he sold his ass to Morgan McSweeney, who I still think is hovering out there in the darkness, just swimming off the Houses of Parliament terrace like Jason Bourne in the third Jason Bourne film, snorkeling just up and down outside Parliament. And he will, I guess, make a move to be Labour leader quickly, and then he will turn out to be a tremendous disappointment, delays the whole. Well, we'll see, really. We'll see. Or he'll make some noises about loosening up. Well, I don't know whether he'll try and ameliorate Starmer's and Labour Together's vile authoritarianism.
So Labour Together is now known as Think Labour.
Are they?
And it's a think tank closely aligned with the right wing of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Were they a big part of formulating the anti-Corbyn smears?
Yes,
and stuff?
They were very central in the false allegations of anti-Semitism. The people who were at the core of it were Steve Reed, Shabana Mahmood, I guess Peter Mandelson, but these Morgan McSweeney. And these were the people that put Starmer in place while hiding the fact that they were receiving hundreds of thousands of pounds from pro-Israel interests and gambling interests and other sources of dark money. But they hid that until Starmer was elected. Steve Reed's a particular fucking arsehole, but one of those people. But yeah, they were very central. They were very central to Labour Together, very central to attacking the Canary. You know, I had a column, you know, as I said before, in the Canary, which wasn't a brilliant fit between me and the people who read the Canary. But nevertheless, the way that they moved, because the Canary was actually printing stuff about Labour Together, and was doing things the mainstream media should have been doing, they sabotaged them by, again, false accusations of anti-Semitism, which meant that they lost their financial base. And so that's who, I think that is who, those people who Burnham has done a deal with, really. So we'll see. I think he will become leader of the Labour Party either sooner or later. But then from
you
then
think
on, it'll
he
be
will over West Streeting.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah.
Yeah. But look, I'm to be transparent, I'm not finding anything here about Andy Burnham in Labour Friends of Israel. Are you sure about
that? I read that he joined in 2015.
Well, I'm not seeing that online.
All right.
Anyone at home, feel free to pitch in. Let us know.
Yeah. He certainly has not said anything about the genocide
He won't call it a genocide currently, but I know that he has. So, like I was mentioning earlier, in a recent video of him, he is condemning what Israel has done over the last 2.5 years. And he thinks that's, he doesn't think the war on Gaza, the genocide in Gaza, even though we won't call it that, is just, I don't think he's going to be as bad as Starmer, who said, Israel have the right to cut off food and water and electricity and all that.
We'll see.
Just looking at this Middle East Eye article. Maybe just another couple minutes on this. How Andy Burnham stood up to Starmer over Israel and could now reshape UK foreign policy. I'm not here trying to bat for Andy Burnham, by the way. I'm just, you know,
Maybe your youthful naivete will win out over my elderly cynicism.
Maybe relatively youthful and relatively naive, but I think I'm past that. Well, I'm not.
If he does, then good. You know, we'll see.
Okay. After resounding win in Makerfield, Burnham can now challenge Starmer in what looks like a battle over who will lead the UK. Is this all just kind of hypothetical?
Presumably he mounts a challenge, right? I mean, I would be pleased to see Starmer get fucking, you know,
humiliated as well, which
hateful
is...
Hateful little prick. Yeah. I mean, just the most spectacularly unpleasant individual.
As a foreign policy issue, Israel has been significant in Britain over the past 2+ years because of its genocide in Gaza. And in the past few months, the US-Israeli war in Iran has had a significant economic impact on Britain. Burnham was reticent to speak about foreign policy. According to sources within Labour, he and his team believed it would not help him win Makerfield. Yeah, it's such a shame that people feel like they need to hold their tongue on the biggest issue that everyone fucking cares about.
Yeah.
But Burnham will now be forced to turn seriously to the topic.
Middle East Eye says this.
Yes. You'll be keen to respond to the green insurgency and win back left-wing voters, which is what Keir Starmer has been so bad at.
Yeah.
And instead of trying to be in opposition to reform, he's just trying to appease voters by speaking their language. It's like, that's not how you... Okay, so I guess what this is saying is now is it... When the leadership race begins, that's going to be, we're going to see his true colors, really, or we're going to see where he stands and all that. And
okay, all right. Well, let's
I know we want the downfall of the Labour Party, but I also do want something good to happen at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
I want our country to have policies that oppose a fucking genocide.
Like, yeah. Well, let's see. We'll be keeping an eye on this for you people, listeners, and, you know, we are forced to be reckoned with on the left in the new media. So people will be having the various runners and riders on the show. Andy Burnham, Starmer, David Lammy is coming on next week. Shabana Mahmood, we're interviewing Yvette Cooper. You know, we'll all be coming on.
And now back to Raven, her cat, and the impending delivery. 4-hour time slot. Is that the delivery coming now? No, it wasn't. That was just a Green Party leafletter. Speaking of next week, we are actually on break next week. I am on a much needed holiday. We won't be doing a podcast next week, I'm afraid, listeners, but we will be back the week after with a very special guest.
Very special guest. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've been reading Molly Crabapple will be our guest.
Yes.
And I've been reading her book about
Bund,
where
Bund.
We live, this is our land, I think is the history of the Jewish Bund, the socialist.
Where we live is our country. The story of the Jewish Bund.
Country, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating, really. And it's also, because it's not just about the Bund, but it's a kind of history of European politics in a way, late 19th century through to, I don't know when, because I haven't finished the book yet. But, you know, you sort of see the same things, the same scapegoating of immigrants, the same forces, the same stupidity on the left of not acting fast enough or with enough decisiveness, you know, constant that you know, which is a perennial problem on the left. So yeah, it's a really fascinating, it's a really fantastic book, really, and I will have read it all by the time we speak to Molly Crabapple next week.
Week after next. What else are you reading, or what are you watching at the moment, Alexa?
What am I watching? Thank you. What am I watching, Talal? That's a good question. I see there's a new Harlan Coben coming. Have you ever watched a Harlan Coben?
Oh,
usually
no.
Starred Jimmy, what's he called? James Nesbitt. Often, or somebody looks like James Nesbitt. And they start off like really fantastic and then, you know, with an amazing premise. And you think, how did they do that? And then you realize it's just absolute crap. They never really resolve how they did that. But one of the things
Harlan Coben is a writer?
Yeah.
And he writes books and they make TV shows. Are you reading a book or watching a TV?
We watched quite a lot, particularly, I think, over lockdown, and we watched a lot of Harlan Coben's.
Oh, he writes mysteries.
Yeah. And then I think his daughter also writes mysteries. And then I guess he probably has people who knock them out.
Okay. God, sometimes you say things and I'm just scrambling to figure out what the fuck you're talking about. All right, so
Harlan Coben.
Yeah, I didn't know. Those are such random syllables. Fool Me Once, Shelter, Stay Close, yeah. Missing You are all TV shows of Harlan Coben stories. Okay.
They set them in these kind of composite towns. So I remember seeing one that was and so they choose the best, you know, it's like it's supposed to be one town, but they actually choose the best. So there was one set in the northwest, and so they would leave their house and then turn onto the seafront at Southport or somewhere. Uh-huh. Then they'd turn again, and then they'd be on the high street in Lancaster by the castle and stuff. So you they're visually very attractive because they're just set in these composite towns that don't exist, you know, but which are just redolent with all kinds of amazing and forests. There's usually a forest.
All right.
There's often a forest.
This is an American writer, so they're American shows. So they're
all made in. Yes, I think, there's a production company, I can't remember who it is now, who've kind of worked out this formula of knocking them out for British television, and they set them in Britain.
Do you remember that show You on Netflix? About this weird stalker guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
My girlfriend was watching it, and there was a season of it was set in London, but it's for an American audience.
Yeah.
And I think he was working in like a university in like Kensington or something, and he meets someone. He goes, oh, you want to walk home with me? And she's like, yeah, sure. Where do you live? And he's like, Shoreditch. All right, let's go. And they're like walking into Americans, they don't know that it's like a fucking 3.5 hour walk.
Yeah.
You know, it's watching this going, what the fuck kind of walk is that? Pleasant stroll you're doing. And they did the same thing in Lena Dunham's latest show. Lena Dunham's who made Girls.
Yeah.
She did a series set in London.
Oh, it was shocking.
It was so bad. Yeah. And again, like, he's like, let's take a walk. And before you know it, they've walked across all of London.
There's usually the Gherkins always in a shot. It used to be for a while.
Yeah.
It's like when Woody Allen started, but nobody would finance Woody Allen's films in the States, so he started making films in Europe and realized he was shit. It was just only America that was making him seem good. I mean,
right, yeah.
Like Match Point, I think, was one. Just terrible. Although I think it was actually all these great films. He went through a mate with all these. I mean, I think also a terrible person. Although I think we had this conversation. And Mia Farrow was his muse, really. And he was good when he was with her. And then as soon as they split up, his films went right off. But yeah, no, everything set in any American thing set in London is always diabolical. I mean, it's, you know, from going back to, you know, when Friends came to London.
Yes.
We were on a break in London. Yeah. You slept, you know.
Richard Branson selling T-shirts on the Thames.
That's right, yeah, all that kind of nonsense.
Yeah. The fuck was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, they just they view London as this quaint little village, don't they?
Yeah, it's just, yeah, they just, well, because they're sophisticated people. You'd think they'd, like, you know, they'd just get it right, really. But it's...
We should do a show in, a British show set in New York and treat it the same way.
Mm.
And, like, yeah, have you, you walk out the door in Brooklyn and then suddenly you're in Manhattan and driving on the left side of the road.
Yeah. This is one you'll never find for Alexi Reacts. I remember doing, I think it was for the opening night of Channel 5. I may have got some details of this wrong, but I was and it was, I think it was Lee Francis, you know, very, very strange. Like, you know, that did Beau Selector and all that, very odd character.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was him. I think he was, I remember Davina McCall was in it. I remember for everybody's really nice. Everybody's really nice on the cast. I remember chatting with Davina McCall and I was saying, what have you got in your box of memories? And I said, tickets up from a film I saw in 1987. She said, I've got my Olympic torch that I carried through London, you know, for the Olympic Games. Oh, yeah. All right. You win. But this thing, whatever it was, the joke was supposed to be that at one point, I think they go and have a, I don't remember why, they go and have an X-ray, right? And then Lee Francis and possibly that bear that he used to do that with an erection.
Yeah.
But they're going to have an X-ray. And then the reveal was going to be that the X-ray operator was David Bailey, right? Which was a kind of a joke, you know. I mean, it's not.
Who's, you know, David Bailey?
Oh, for fuck's sake. You don't know David Bailey is only the greatest photographer of his generation.
Oh, right, okay. And he's the, okay, he's the,
he's the radiographer, right? But at the last minute, or I don't even know if it was the last minute, David Bailey refused to be in it. And so it turns out, like, when they say, okay, your X-ray's done, then I step out. And it's not the joke. It's not like, there's doesn't, no joke the same, there. I'm not a famous photographer. No. I have no memory. I don't know what it was called. I know
it was it called a bear's tail?
Was that, yeah, was it the opening night of Channel 4?
No. No, it was just a Channel 4 sitcom that,
was
that
it?
Lee Francis made in 2005.
He's a very strange boy.
Yeah. Me and my family enjoyed his Michael Jackson movie that he made.
Right. Didn't he ruin, like, Craig David's life?
Right? Yeah, yeah, he's an absolute monster. He's shit. But
they gave me a shitload of money for not being David Bailey.
Just doing that one scene.
Yeah, that's it. I was like, oh, your photo's done out. And I said, look, it's me, Alexi Sale, who's not a famous photographer.
That doesn't make any sense.
No, it didn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, it was a spin-off of his Beau Selector character. It's called A Bear's Tale in 2005.
So he talked a lot about Beau Selector as if I'd seen it, which of course I hadn't. So I didn't know what the fuck he was talking about. But like,
you know, I'm thinking maybe a new ongoing segment we could do.
Have we got enough segments? Yeah, go on.
The podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Every time we start an episode, I open up your IMDb just to kind of have it to fall back on.
See if I've done anything.
If we run out of shit to talk about, I'll just pick a random thing on your IMDb. And it's happened a few times. And now I just do it out of habit. I have it there as an emergency, you know, ripcord. Mm. But I was thinking maybe we could, like, go through it from the earliest to the latest and try and rank your the things you've worked on. And, you know, just do like five at a time, and then I'll slowly build up a list of Alexi's top projects that he's worked on. And
I suppose so. You get anybody like that?
Would anybody like that?
Would the world, is the world crying out for that? In a time when the Straits of Hormuz remain blocked, is anybody really?
Yeah, it's what the world needs. Like, for example, if we were to, how do I do? If I were to start, okay, I've done it. I figured it out. So, like, the first thing on your IMDb is something called Repeater. Yeah?
Right.
From what year? 1979.
Mm-hmm.
So, automatically, that becomes number one on the list, yeah? Because it's the only thing we have. But then we've got a short film called Transmogrification from 1980. Do you have any memories of this?
Well, I think, yeah, these are both connected with my time at Chelsea Art School, I think. I think that Repeater is actually made by a guy I was at Chelsea with called Chris Munger, who later went on to be film director, wrote and directed a film called The Man Who Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mountain with, what's his face? Him out of Four Weddings and a Funeral. And I think Transmogrification is the film I did with it stars me and Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Film? No.
That we've talked about. Is that film? Yes. When me and Jacob Rees-Mogg were a double act.
When you used to bounce him on your knee.
Yes, exactly.
So my question would be, what do you think's better? Transmogrification or Repeater?
I don't know. They both have their attributes.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever seen Transmogrification, but it's a bizarre side note in my history.
Mm-hmm.
Repeater, I don't know, it's quite avant-garde.
Well, you have to choose. Which one should I put on top?
Because I like Dan, my tutor who's dead, I'd rate Transmogrification over Repeater.
Okay, great. Transmog, and it's Rees-Moggification. Transmogrification, 1980, is now number one on the list, and Repeater is number two. Then The next thing we have is Lost for Words.
Oh, what the fuck? I don't know what that is. What the fuck?
You don't know what that is?
No.
All right, I'll put that last then.
I think it was something I did. There used to be because when I taught, when I was a college lecturer, you couldn't, the GLC, all London colleges had their own TV channel. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just plug your telly into the show a film, or you had to plug this. Every room had a monitor in it, which plugged into this.
Like a switchboard kind of
thing?
Yeah,
like a kind of, and it was like a kind of intranet. And it was like a London-wide TV channel run by the GLC and the Inner London Education Authority. Some people may want to, fill us in on this. It was quite an interesting thing, really. So, yeah, there was this, I think it was a hotbed of Marxism and stuff. So when Ken Livingstone was in charge of the GLC, and they had their own, and they used to make educational programs, for their channel as well. And I think Lost for Words is about language use. I think it was written, I'm guessing that, but I think it was written by my late friend David Stafford, and I think starred me and Andy De La Tour, I seem to remember.
Okay. Memories are flooding back.
Yeah, but so, yeah, I'd be interested if anybody wanted to fill us in about the GLC or the ILEA in the London Education Authority TV network. I think they were based in Alexandra Palace. Yeah, I think it was like a hotbed, of like radicalism and stuff, and obviously Thatcher closed it down. Sinecure for people who failed elsewhere.
All right.
Probably. So tell us about that.
Yeah. If anyone can find the footage of that.
Yeah.
Let us know.
Because I also did for them, which was also David Stafford. Was in it. I did a production of the Caucasian Chalk Circle for that same network, I think. Or was it for maybe it was just for Schools TV. No, maybe it was that was for Schools TV. That was for Thames. I don't know if that's in my IMDb. But I played Grusha's uncle. And I gave myself a sort of northern accent. And I often think I said, "Grusha, the snows are melting, and soon the soldiers will be here." And I often think that around about springtime. I think to myself, "Grusha, the snows are melting, and soon the soldiers will be here."
The Caucasian Chalk Circle is...
The Cork
Arthur
Chalk.
Miller?
No, fuck off. It's Bertolt Brecht.
It's Brecht?
Yeah. It's very good. It's about yes. Asdak, this kind of...
No. I remember it. I remember it from high school drama. My class did Arturo Uy, and I played Uy. I played Arturo, and the other class did Chalk Circle. And we both performed it for...
Right.
We performed it for the year, the school year.
And Mark Gatiss has just done a fantastic, apparently.
Yes.
Production of Arturo Uy.
Yes.
Up in Stratford. I don't think... No, they're bringing it to London, but it looked amazing. And, you know, there's great lines. Get up the line, the last line of Arturo Uy. Can you get them up? Can you call them up?
Yeah, which line?
The very last line.
His final speech.
Yes.
If we could learn to look instead of gawking, we'd see the horror in the heart of farce. If only we could act instead of talking, we wouldn't always end up on our arse. Don't rejoice in his defeat, you men. Although the world stood up and defeated the bastard, the bitch that bore him is in heat again.
Just so fucking, those are words to send a chill down your spine, aren't they? I mean, that's such a great piece of writing. You know,
Arturo Uy, of course, was an allegory for Hitler.
Yes, it was a vegetable seller who, you know.
This fucking holds up, doesn't it, man? Mm. Bloody hell.
So fucking
the bitch
powerful,
that bore him is still
on heat again. I would say the bitch, again. You know, the bitch, you know, it's not, you know, it's Keir Starmer is Hitler. Shabana Mahmood, you know. Yvette Cooper.
Okay.
Grusha, the snows are melting and soon the soldiers will be here.
Now that all this memory's come back, Lost for Words is still at the bottom of the list. Are you happy with that?
Yes, I don't think Lost for Words really made it, you know, in terms of cinematography.
Okay. We're going to do two more. I want to try and do five each time we do this.
All right.
Next up is, so we're getting Alexis Sales official IMDb ranking. Next up we have, in 1981, you did Walcott. Oh, that's the one we did a react to recently, isn't it?
Yeah.
You played an anti-fascist soapbox speaker, and your mate Keith was a fash who came and heckled you, causing a little scuffle in one episode of Walcott, the mini-series about a black London detective, which was a shocking thing to see in 1981. What do you think? Do you want to put that above Repeater, above Transmogrification?
Well, it was sort of...
It's your personal
preference. Made by professional people. It was like a lunch wagon and stuff. Does that...
Yeah?
Does that rank it?
Well, where does it sit, rank in your heart? So you think it is better? Better quality stuff, do you?
Walcott, not really. It's pretty stupid.
And think about your performance in it and... What do you think?
I would rank it below. I would rank it last. Walcott.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Shocking turn of events. Walcott, 1981. All right. Last one. We've got Boom Boom, Out Go the Lights.
Boom Boom, Out Go the Lights.
TV special from 1981. Now this, I've heard this phrase so many times. And is this where it was like a stand-up variety show in your hosting it, or you do a slot on it?
Well, Paul Jackson, who was the first TV executive to realize that something was going on, down at the Comedy Store, persuaded his bosses at, who's then a young light entertainment producer, persuaded his bosses to do two shows. They're both called Boom Boom Outgo Lights. No, the other one was called Stomping on the Cat, I think. A Ronnie Golden song. But the terrible mistake, I don't think I hosted the first one. The terrible mistake Paul made was he tried to split up the double act. So he actually, because he thought, like, well, Rick's the talented one out of Rick and Aid, and Nigel's the talented one out of Pete and Nigel. So I'll put Rick with Nigel.
No.
Yes, it was a very, very.
Oh, no.
It was a very, very bad mistake. And I think it also probably caused a sort of aggravation between the double X as well, because they went along with it, you know. And so it was bad. It was bad karmically, as it were. But it's also, it's a misunderstanding of how double X work, really, that there's a, you know, that there is a kind of a chemistry between those two performers that you can't, the one isn't really funnier than the other, you know.
Yeah, they're talented because they support each other and bring the best out of each other. Yeah.
So it wasn't really very.
It was a follow up.
And the follow up was called.
It was a follow up to the previous year's special of the same name. So they were both.
And I was the MC of that one. Yeah.
Right.
And he put all the double acts back together. But that's the one where I rang up my mother. I think it was Boom Boom. Rang up my mother the next day, first time I was on, you know, TV, and said, "What do you think?" And she said, "Well, Keith Allen wasn't very good either."
Classic line. Your mum roasted Molly. You.
Yeah.
It was included as an extra on the Blu-ray release of The Young Ones.
Oh, really? Oh,
yes.
Okay. It had a weird mixture of people as well, like Maggie Steed and Paola Donizetti. There were sort of youngish actresses who. And Pauline Melville, like doing her character Edie, was also in it.
On the Blu-ray, Paul Jackson does a specially recorded introduction for it. Described it as a fun piece. It's much closer to what went on to become The Young Ones. You could see where Young Ones came from. And in fact, in between the recording of the two shows, I got the script of The Young Ones, which Rick and Aid and Ben had given me and Lisa. And we were already starting to talk about trying to get it on the television. All these ers and ahs are in this quote. Yeah. I don't know why they've written it.
There's this weird interview in the Telegraph with Ben, which was on my phone. My phone, for some reason, lets me read articles. In the Telegraph, where Ben was claiming that he was the sole author of the pilot of The Young Ones, which is apparently in his book as well. And that's simply not true. And I don't know why and he also says he was down to play Mike, the character Mike, and then Rick wouldn't let him. And that was also not true. And he clearly didn't write the pilot of The Young Ones, because I mean, I'm credited as additional material. I wrote 5 minutes of it. I don't know what he's trying. I'm not having a go at him in a sense. I just think he's making himself unhappy. I mean, so successful. I don't know why he has to go back in history and claim to have done things that he didn't do, really, because he's done so many things that are. It's it's a very strange impulse, and anybody wants to kind of.
Yeah, I saw him on a recent Romesh's podcast.
Mm.
Talking about how he was taking, I don't know how much of this is true or not, but he was taking a lot of credit for Blackadder being what it was.
Well, again, I don't know, because he's rather building his own part in that. I mean, I think the real hero of Blackadder was John Lloyd, the producer, really. Both Richard and Ben are both people who are not people who are terribly hard on themselves. And I think what Lloydie did, which made Blackadder the second series really good, was that he wrote them and wouldn't accept second-rate stuff that they handed in at first, really.
Right.
I think Lloydie doesn't really get credit that he should got, you know, got for that series, really. But again, I think, yes, I know so many people have said that Ben has been rather, I say it's because it sort of comes across as sort of unhappiness, really, that he did clearly co-write Blackadder.
Which is enough, why
can't be happy with that and be generous with, you know, but to sort of claim he's a funny boy.
All right, listeners, you heard that. Go tell Ben what was said on this show and let's stir up some beef. Let's make some tabloid headlines.
Well, I don't want to. I mean, I used to do that with it. I'm not doing it out of.
I know.
Cause upset. I'm just. I think it'd make him happier if he just kind of laid back a bit on.
Yeah, give other people
a bit of room, really.
And we strive to seek out the truth here on the Let's Start podcast as well. Look, last bit of trivia on Boom Boom Out Go the Lights is about you, Alexi. In addition to the two characters listed, Alexi Sale also performs as his familiar Cockney mod character, though the character is unnamed. A variation of the character is called Reggie in Bomb, 1982, though featured
Reggie
as part
Blosky, yeah.
The, yeah. Oh, the Young Ones episode, though featured as part of Sale's stand-up, with no variation between the character and his real... Oh, great bit of trivia there, IMDb. Good work. So you're listed as playing three characters in this.
Right.
But Boom Boom Out Go the Lights, we'll combine both episodes, both specials as one. So this is the last one we're looking at today. I want you to tell me where you rank
it. Well, I suppose they were, you know, I mean, that's where we met Paul and that's where... He's right, that's where that relationship between Rick and Lisa and I guess Ben was made, which led to the Young Ones, really. So, you know, it should be up there at the top, really.
Up at the top, over, above transmogrification, yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
Just because of the impact it had on everyone's career. Four dots in the ellipses there. Interesting choice. What about the title? Where did that come from?
It's from the guest band in the were called the guest band in the first episode were a group called Nine Below Zero, which was fronted by ex-Manfred Mann front man. I think what was the show called again? Boom, boom. Yeah, Nine Below Zero. They had a song called, of which the chorus was, "Boom, boom, out go the lights." Little, long forgotten piece of kind of East Endy pub thrash, Dr. Feelgood.
Nice. So it was like a punky, rocky music reference, which is what.
Boom, boom, out go the lights.
Okay, great. So we have our first ranking of five things. We've got in fifth place, Walcott, fourth place, Lost for Words, third place, Repeater, second place, Transmogrification, and in first place, Boom Boom Out Go the Lights. I'm now saving
this. Stomping on the Cat, which was based on a rather unpleasant Ronnie Golden, who plays Buddy Holly in the Young Ones, routine about, I think, where he got out of bed and stood on a kitten, I think.
Fucking hell. Right.
I know.
We'll come at this again. We'll add another five to the list. What do you think of this little segment?
Shit. But it's absolute shit.
Great.
Boom, boom. Out go the lights. For a drink with Richard Pryor, he gave me a Sprite. Boom, boom. Out go the lights. Woke up and my trousers were all ruffled. Boom, boom, out go the lights.
Anything else you want to talk about?
No, not really. No.
Let me send you a picture someone has. Have you got your phone on you? All right, someone on our Patreon has sent us something.
Boom, boom, out go the lights.
Okay, I'm sending you an image there. You can pinch to zoom to make it bigger. This is from Ian. Was lovely to hear John Otway get a shout out on the latest episode. That was 2 weeks ago now. He seems like a good bloke by all accounts. Does Alexi have any noteworthy anecdotes from that tour?
Oh, let me have a think. I mean, there are... I've never got that many anecdotes really about John Otway, but...
Was having a look for any contemporaneous reviews and came across this flyer. Nice to see Mr. Chariot getting the proper billing. So I've sent Alexi this image of the flyer. It's the all-new Alexi Sale tour. And Bobby Chariot plus special guest John Otway, 31st of October, Birmingham Symphony Hall.
That might have been the last tour that I did, really, where, you know, which caused me to give up.
From 1995.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's when I stopped.
Caused you to give up?
For 17 years, yeah.
Was it that bad?
I talked about it. It was a great show, people, but I'd grown sick of it, really.
Are you looking at the image, or have you just started looking at other messages? Oh, you are.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Does it bring back any memories, any anecdotes of John Otway?
No, I don't. I'll talk to Linda soon. She'll have anecdotes.
Okay. All right. Stay tuned for that. We'll find out the shocking results of whether Raven and her cat get that delivery. what Mrs. Bryans will do with the fortune from her Incan golden idol heads. And of course, whether Alexi Sell has any anecdotes of his time with John Otway. Someone also asks, would you ever consider doing, O'Brien asks, would you ever consider doing Bobby Chariot again?
Well, he's sort of, I did try and occasionally kind of revive. His wig and his teeth are in the cupboard somewhere. But I think my teeth will, I mean, I'd have to get the teeth made. I don't think you could maybe do him on radio. I don't think I would. I love Bobby and I, I'm not a great character comic, really. He's the only really, truly great character that I ever created. It was Bobby, really. And I loved him. And I feel a slight sense of frustration. I could have perhaps done more with him. But on the other hand, I mean, those bits on the all-new Alexi Sale show, you know, written by me and Graham Lynn and Arthur Matthews, they are just stupendous, really.
Yeah, you could see him having like a Alan Partridge style.
Yeah. I think if I'd been less stupid and more of a kind of had my shit together in the 90s, then I would have, I would have done more with him, really. But, in Merry-Go-Round, he does come outside the studio. I don't know how well that works, really, but, I could have done more with Bobby, but I think probably the time's passed now.
If you were to do him today in like a YouTube skit or a podcast or episode or something, would you consider putting like a graying version of his wig on and doing an age, you know, he would have grown up in the interim years as well, and he'd be an aging comic now.
But that'd cost a lot, wouldn't it? I mean, I will also, I'm not shaving my beard off because I don't know who's underneath.
No, well, he could have a big white beard.
Big white beard.
Graying afro and...
he's not a bearded man, though, is he, Bobby, really? He's not a man with a beard, I think.
Well, you never were. And look at now. What do you think what do you think has happened in his life since we last saw him? Where is he now? You know, is he still touring and trying to
sleeping in his Jag on pills for his nerves?
Is he doing a monthly night above a pub, emceeing a comedy night?
Yeah, he was briefly taken up by hipsters and then dropped again, I think. I think he's probably working as a secure night watchman at B&Q.
Yeah, he'll go do a gig and then start his shift at B&Q.
Yeah. everybody's got fans, haven't they, really? So there'd be a small, I don't know if we, you know, I mean, so that was what I thought, that was one of the clever things about Flight of the Conchords, that they were, you know, tremendously, they had a tiny, it was only like a couple of people, wasn't it?
Yeah, they had one diehard fan. They had a
few fans, you know. Yeah. There's nobody, I don't know of anybody really, any act who's so bad that they don't have a few diehard fans, really. It's quite an interesting sort of idea, really. And so Bobby would have a few diehard fans, wouldn't they, drive these days, especially with the kind of modern irony. Yeah, he'd probably... Yeah, there'd be people who really... he could maybe... I don't know if he could go to Comic-Con, you know. I don't know.
It would be a like our dance videos. He'd have a diehard TikTok followers, but they're in like South America and the Philippines.
Yeah.
There's no one in fucking London, you know? No one in England. Right. Any other business, or shall we call it there?
All right.
Send us your messages on alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know if you have found the footage of that thing we were talking about, Lost for Words. And please think about supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. You thought you were going to get away with not hearing a bloody Patreon advert. No. Just a few quid a month means a great deal. You can keep this machine going. It's patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. I won't bore you with telling you all of the amazing bonus features you get for being a Patreon member. I'll let you off light this week because I left it so late. All right, thank you. I'm done. Let's go do an Alexi React.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the AlexisLPodcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.